science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Zakowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker, from social media. They're the Twitter science dogs. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we take a deep dive into a timely science article and look at the research that's going on with our pets. In our Ask an Expert section, we have guests that will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Science Podcast. We hope everybody is happy and healthy out there. Well, the summer for Chris and I is almost over, and Adam too. And that means we're gearing up to get back to school. By the time you listen to this, we'll probably be in and out of the school planning. We're both really not sure what's going to happen with the kids in school. We don't know what our classrooms are going to look like. It kind of appears like business is normal. Aside from having masks in common areas, kids will be in and out of our classes without masks. We still have really low case positivity with COVID-19 compared to a lot of places. So the risk level, at least to start with, I think is going to be kind of pretty low for us. But all it takes is somebody to bring COVID from somewhere else or get it themselves and then come to school. So that's what all the teachers are really worried about. On the dog front, Beaker continues to grow like a weed, and she is just so bouncy and athletic now. We caught her walking along the top of the couch, and then she was trying to get a fly. A fly went up there. She was trying to eat the fly, and she kind of like T-I-double-g-erred herself up there and was trying to chase down the fly. All right, what's happening on the program today? Well, in science news, we're going to take a look at a really interesting paper that tracked how animals use physical and social distancing to stop the spread of pathogens. It's fascinating. In pet science, we're going to look at, I guess, an update to see if cats and dogs are susceptible to getting COVID-19 or getting COVID-19 and giving them to you. Our guest this week in Ask an Expert is Sarah Michelle Olson, who is an amazing science communicator and an author. I can't wait for you guys to listen to her conversation. It's so good. Hey dogs, I'm really sorry. We were going to go hiking this weekend, but I just got really into this story and I'm all booked up. I only have my shelf to blame. Okay, let's get on with the show because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to take a look at an article that was published in the Royal Society called Emerging Infectious Disease and the Challenges of Social Distancing in Humans and Non-Human Animals. So in a nutshell, it's a really cool article because it takes a look at what animals do when they're exposed to pathogens, especially animals that are social, animals that exist in groups, family units. Do they do social distancing when somebody gets sick? When a little bird or a bat gets sick? Well, it turns out they do. Now, we know with humans that social distancing works. If you check the stats, and they're kind of all over the place, but it's somewhere around 50% to 75% that nations that got social distancing going early stopped the spread of SARS-CoV-2 by huge amounts by doing social distancing. And for a lot of people, it's been really tough. It's been tough emotionally because you've had to be separated from family. If somebody got sick, you had to be separated from them. My sister just had a little baby, and this last couple days was the first time we've got to see the baby because of social distancing. Even though Alberta and Saskatchewan, they live a province over from us, they have really low COVID-19 numbers. We didn't get to see them. We had to be careful around my parents. And that's just like my family, right? We are so fortunate and privileged because we live in the country. We have wide open spaces to go explore. We're not trapped in an apartment in a big city. Also, social distancing has definitely impacted many, many families financially. Some jobs just stopped being a job because you were laid off. Your job couldn't function because it was shut down. Social distancing has been also shown to slow Ebola, H1N1, and other diseases in human history. It does appear, though, based on this article, that animals have success in slowing pathogen transmission by doing social distancing. First off, one of the things this article talked about that was really cool was animals do recognize when other members of their pod or their social group are sick. For example, birds and fish are really good at identifying sick-looking members. They, like, if they're moving slower than usual, they can identify that that individual is sick. Primates will ignore or ostracize members that are acting differently. To start with, there's more research that goes into that, that if somebody's, you know, an animal within that pod has cancer, they might ostracize them initially, but then help them out later. So once these social animals recognize that a member is sick, do they do similar things to what humans have done in our past with social distancing? And there's tons of evidence. So the paper, this article is actually quite long, so I'm just going to go into a couple really interesting parts of it. So they took a look at animals that social distance when their community is being affected by pathogens. These little brown bats were found to roost more individually. So I don't know if you've seen little bats roost. They hang upside down and they kind of cuddle into each other. They're really cute. When there is a fungal pathogen called Geomyces destructicans, sounds so terrible. Anyways, when this fungal pathogen gets into their group, there is a much higher increase of individual roosting to show that they know it's being spread around and they will increase their survival chances if they sleep or rest separately. Unaffected Caribbean spiny lobsters are also more likely to abandon their den if there's a virus that is affecting their pod or their group of lobsters. Also, that's just if there is a sickness within a group, there's social distancing that happens. Some animals will act altruistically if they themselves are sick. So they will social distance themselves from the community. They looked at bees when this pathogen called Vero Destructicor. They always have such terrible... Anyway, so this pathogen would ravage a hive if it spread. And if a bee got the pathogen, it just decreased its rate of returning to the hive dramatically, and usually that caused its death. And so while it definitely, that behavior definitely decreased its chance of survival, the continuation of hive health was preserved. Another interesting thing that happens in the animal kingdom, which we're seeing a little bit and a lot of it in places in humans, increased modularity or xenophobia. So that's basically where your group looks at anybody not of your group with increased suspicion or fear. So ants and primates close off their groups when their group has pathogens spreading throughout it, meaning that some ant colonies will let other ant colonies mingle, and some primate colonies will let other primate colonies intermingle. But when they're infected, their group is infected by a pathogen, they basically shut down their borders and they don't allow mingling. And we've seen this throughout human history when countries have closed off or regions, cities, or even towns or families, and other countries or regions are seen and looked upon with suspicion or fear. Now, I'll just speak about Canada right now. We have this great big border with our American friends. I'll just say there is a lot of fear of opening the border up and letting the Americans come across to vacation because our rates of COVID are so vastly different. And the border was actually just closed for another 30 days. I think until the end of September, they're going to relook at opening it. Now, not all groups do social distancing when there's a sickness. So the article was quick to point out some really interesting other types of animals that don't social distance. Different types of cats will actually form tighter bonds within families that fall ill. So that it might, like a family member of a cat group get like a pathogen, get something they could transmit, they will actually form a tighter bond and have more grooming and increase the chances of it spreading within the family group. And that, though, has a similar mirror to humans, because when family members within a family fall ill, others will step up and take over as a caregiver. They were also they pointed out some odd some odd animal behaviors that have stood the test of time evolutionarily wise, meaning that even though it would be better if the group socially distant, they don't do it because other evolutionary things override that. And one of the things they looked at was Tasmanian devils. So I was probably a teenager when I found out that Tasmanian devils were real. I thought they were fake. I thought they were not a real thing because of the Tasmanian devil from Looney Tunes. You know, the guy went like, blah, blah, and he would spin around and wreck stuff. I just thought it was I didn't know they were real. You know, there wasn't internet at that time, and unless you saw a TV program or a book that said Tasmanian devil, I just thought they were fake. So anyway, so that caught my eye. Anyway, so Tasmanian devils, there's actually this disease called devil facial tumor. Gross. And it's actually something that could cause the entire group of Tasmanian devils to go extinct, like all of them. It's super fatal. And it's transmitted kind of grossly. What happens is an aggressive male or an aggressive Tasmanian devil will bite the tumor of a subordinate, and that causes it to burst and spread. You think that that behavior would stop because it's something that's decreasing the survivability of their species by spreading the virus through that behavior. The problem is that the females, the females of the species will always select, when given the choice, the most aggressive male. So even though that aggressive, crazy biting of the tumor behavior is something they do, it's selected by the females as a good trait to pass on, so it lives. Another really cool thing this article points out is that some pathogens will affect the individual greater than the group. And it's just how it's transmitted. For example, West Nile spreads among robins that are more solitary than groups of robins. And it could be because West Nile is transmitted among them by mosquito bite, and having giant flocks of robins might disperse the mosquitoes as opposed to one single robin, which is a greater, you know, easier mark for the bugs. Also, some family units are so tight that even to their disadvantage, they will not social distance. And gray wolves are an example. When mange or some other disease is passing through a group of gray wolves, a family, they don't social distance. They will take their lumps because it really appears that even though they're working as a unit and many might get sick and many might die, that unit is more efficient in survival than an individual gray wolf. So while there are many, many examples in the animal kingdom of animals doing social distancing like humans, there are some exceptions. Really depends on how virulent and deadly the disease is. The more virulent and the more deadly the disease, the greater the chance the animals will social distance. It's something I worry about in the future. Can humanity rise to the occasion? Can every nation do better if another pandemic comes along? I mean, we're still in this one. If you look at the numbers in some areas, we're going up, right? This pandemic is not in the second wave in a lot of countries. So we can learn a little bit from animals. Social distance, and if you're sick, social distance yourself. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we're going to look at an update on COVID transmission in dogs and cats. So you might have saw, and I did because Bunsen's account got tagged a billion times, that sadly, the first U.S. dog to definitively test positive for COVID-19 has died. The dog was a German Shepherd named Buddy, who lived in New York City. The dog likely had lymphoma, but died of COVID-19. So from that, there was, I don't want to say a panic, but I want to say concern, maybe bordering on panic, that for people who haven't been following it, especially the dog in China that died of COVID-19, that COVID-19 was going to spread to dogs and cats or from dogs and cats to humans. So I thought I would give you the updated information on what the scientists and epidemiologists are saying about SARS-CoV-2 and our pets. Now, I'm going to be using the United States instead of Canada data because, sadly, there's just way more of it because there's way more cases. There are a lot of places that, even right now, I know there some of the surge areas are slowing. There are a lot of places in the United States where the COVID-19 numbers are going up, or at least they're elevated. And that, of course, is causing people to worry about that. If lots of people are testing positive for COVID, does that mean my pet can get it? As of right now, veterinarians are working really hard to figure this out. Scientists are too. But the long and short of it is it's unclear. Now, that being said, let's go and take a look at the up-to-date data. The big takeaway is that we as humans are a bigger threat to give it to our pets than pets are to us. All of the different data shows that there's been zero transmission confirmed cases from a dog to a human or a cat to a human. So that means you are way more likely to get COVID-19 from an unwashed grocery cart than from having your dog or your cat say hello to you. Almost all of the pets that have tested positive for coronavirus have got it from humans. Some pets, like some cats, have got it from other cats. You might have remembered there were some tigers and lions that were sick at the New York Zoo, the Bronx Zoo. It appears they got the virus from humans. All of this is a bit murky because we're not, scientists aren't specifically concerned or really working that hard at testing animals. The big push is to test humans to make sure, keep people from spreading the virus in human populations, not so much in animal populations. There have been a few studies that have proved that cats can transmit SARS-CoV-2 to other cats, but that was in a laboratory scenario. There have been some other papers that have been published, but they are like in pre-publication status, meaning they have yet to be peer-reviewed. So again, it's murky. Another thing that's interesting is that in cats, it doesn't appear that the cats will show that they have any symptoms. The only studies that have come out have concluded that the symptoms are either mild or completely non-existent, which means if cats can give it to humans, they're probably pretty sneaky and quiet about it. So you're not going to see your cat feverish or coughing or anything. They'll just test positive for it. So if there is a small chance, like quote unquote small, maybe even non-existent chance that your pet could have coronavirus and could give it to you or other pets, should you get them tested? Well, there are pet tests available. I didn't even know this. There are pet tests for coronavirus, but they're like crazy hard to find. If you went to your doctor and you said, hey, could you test my cat? They would probably say, what is the matter with you? In fact, a lot of agencies are just not doing it or even advising it because if you get it, what are you going to do with your results? So your dog tests positive for coronavirus. There has been zero evidence to show that that dog could even give that coronavirus to you. So what is the advice with dogs and cats? Well, if you see a dog or cat from another family, it's advised you probably shouldn't pet them. And if you do, wash your hands after. If you're around lots and lots of dogs and cats, you probably should wear a mask. But that probably means you're around the humans that are the owners of the dogs and cats. And it's way more likely that you'd get it from them. So wash your hands and wear a mask because of that reason. There are still way more unanswered questions than I have answers to give you. The long and short of it is, don't panic. There, when that first dog tested positive for coronavirus in Hong Kong, there were people that were seriously taking their animals and abandoning them because they were terrified of getting coronavirus from their pets. More evidence and more data is going to come in every day. There are a bunch of mega studies, and I say mega studies for animals because they're big, of huge groups of pets that have been from families that tested positive for COVID-19. So we're going to have that data in a month or two. I would say don't panic, don't worry. The chances are so low, almost non-existent. We're already social isolating already. It's having our pets with us is the one grace, the one privilege that we might have to get through this. And you know what? If you see a happy dog on the street and you want to pet that happy dog and you're wearing a mask and the owner's wearing a mask, just wash your hands after. You'll be fine. That's pet science for this week.
Before we get to the interview section, I just want to tell everybody a little bit about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible, you can't see me pointing, but it's made possible by people just like you. If you've been listening to the show and you like the content, consider signing up on our Patreon page as a patron. The podcast, unfortunately, isn't free to run, even though we really enjoy doing it. It's been a great addition to our lives. To share more in-depth science news than our Twitter accounts and definitely Instagram can allow. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/Bunsen Burner, and there are four tiers of support. If you head over there, you can see the different monetary amounts, but the lowest one is only $5 a month. That's not that bad. We do about 4 or 5 shows a month. 4 shows, great education and entertainment for $5. Can't beat it. Plus, we send out perks. The other way the show makes money is through merchandise sales. We've worked with a cartoonist to deliver some amazingly adorable merchandise on our merchandise shop, and that's at www.bunsenburnerbmd.com. The links are in the show notes, and you can peruse the adorable merchandise. Thanks, guys. Now, on to the interview. On the Science Podcast, I am delighted to have in the Ask an Expert section, Sarah Olson Mitchell with me, who is a science writer and science communicator. How are you doing today, Sarah?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yay. Sarah, where are you calling into the podcast from in the world?
I'm currently in Corvallis, Oregon.
Oh, Oregon is a beautiful state. I've been through a few times with my family.
So, yeah.
So you're west of us in Alberta then. You're on the coast, I think, close to the coast.
Yeah, I am. I'm about 40 minutes from the central Oregon coast.
Wow. Lucky. I always tell guests I'm so jealous of folks that live near the ocean, because it's something that, being landlocked, Alberta's pretty landlocked, right? It's like your central, I think the Americans call it the flyover states. They're very, very landlocked from the ocean. Yeah. We're jealous because we love going to the ocean. It's super cool.
Yeah. I grew up in, you know, near the ocean. I'm actually from Southern California, and I can't imagine living further than an hour from the ocean, because that's just, I've always been by the coast and I can't imagine leaving. I love the West Coast. I love the Pacific Ocean.
How you and your family coped okay with the whole coronavirus thing? This podcast may air a bit after our chat, but how are you and your family coping with that?
Everyone seems to be doing okay. We did lose my mother's aunt to the coronavirus, but I had never met her before, so it wasn't something that was hard for me to process, but it was kind of surreal knowing, wow, okay, I've lost a relative to this. It's real. But all of us here in Oregon seem to be doing okay.
Yeah, that's good to hear. That's for us in Alberta. I've been talking to guests at the start just about coronavirus, because it's touched everybody and basically the entire world, right? And Alberta has very low amounts of cases, and the average person in Alberta doesn't know somebody that either got it or has died from it. So while we're taking it very seriously, it's I do feel for your family that's lost for someone, but it is real and it's out there. I'm glad you're doing great, and I'm glad your family, for the most part, has done okay. Let's talk a little bit about you. Sarah, can you tell everybody what your training and experience is in science? You've kind of switched gears a bit too from what you've been doing the last little while.
Yeah, so I actually started college back in 2016 as an English literature major, and I had an interest in writing nonfiction, but I didn't really know what my subject would be. And as I started to take my general education classes in community college, I realized I had this love for the biological sciences that I had never explored before. And so I was trying to find a way that I could combine my love for nonfiction writing with studying science. And so I heard about science writing and science journalism. And back in 2018, I had the privilege of being selected for the National Association of Science Writers Undergraduate Science Journalism Fellowship.
Oh, and congratulations.
That was an amazing experience. Yeah, thank you. It was quite a privilege because it was the first time I actually met people who were also at the intersection of enjoying writing, but also being passionate about science and science communication. So that fellowship led to an internship with Purdue University's news service out in Indiana. And so I spent a whole summer writing press releases about the research that their institution does. And I learned a lot about science communication through that. And so over the past couple of years, I've started freelancing for different magazines and online science outlets and learning about what it takes to be a science communicator through the science writing certificate program that they have here at Oregon State University, which is a really unique program, and it's a big part of the reason I decided to transfer here from community college.
Can you talk to everybody about some of the organizations or journals or websites you've written for? I'm just so interested.
Yeah, so one of the most exciting ones for me was I actually got to write a book review for Science Magazine, which, you know, is second to Nature, one of the biggest science outlets out there. And so I wrote a book review, and it was really cool to be able to do that because I love their book reviews. Their section, Books at All, is where I go for my book recommendations and to learn about what's coming out. And so having the opportunity to write for them was just so exciting. Most recently, I was on Science Friday to talk about their annual summer science book recommendations. So we were thinking of books, you know, what can people read during quarantine while they're kind of stuck at home during this pandemic. Yeah, so it was quite a unique opportunity because Science Friday, you know, every year they talk about, oh, what science books to read over the summer. But this year is so different because people really are looking for books to read while they're kind of stuck at home.
So without giving away too much, because we'll have links to that in the show notes, what are a couple of the recommendations that people should be reading?
Well, I think everybody needs to get their hands on Angela Sani's book, Superior, The Return of Race Science. It's such an important
book. Oh, I've heard of this. I've heard of this.
Yeah. Well, not only is she just a phenomenal writer, but her book is so important to the topic that, you know, everybody's talking about right now, which is the Black Lives Matter movement. And Angela Sani is an award-winning science journalist who investigates pseudoscience. So she talks about the studies that basically, I don't know if you can hear my cat in the background.
That's okay. Your cat's just excited about this book.
He really is. He wanted his brother let into the room. That's what was going on.
Oh.
Okay. So Superior is a great book because we should be talking about the Black Lives Matter movement right now. And Angela Sani, she debunks the pseudoscience that led to all these ideas of, you know, white superiority and the biases and prejudices that went into these quote unquote scientific studies that led to this notion that people of color are inferior. And so I think it's one of those books that you get the science, but you also get this really important topic that, you know, we should be thinking about right now. And it's definitely a book anybody could pick up and read.
That's amazing. I'm just so touched you brought that up. I have been interviewing a bunch of amazing Black scientists who have been in Black Birders Week. You know, it's from talking to them, my eyes have been really opened. And just that I was always under the impression when I was a younger person, and even like, you know, five years ago, that science was this impartial machine. But that story of the race science, that they used terrible and awful science to promote racism and to really keep people down. So that book has been recommended for me to read myself. And yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, it's a really common misconception that science is just completely objective, but science is influenced by the people who practice it. And it's something we really have to keep in mind.
Do you have a second book that you could recommend to people from that list?
Well, I'm also reading a book called The Alchemy of Us by Anissa Ramirez. And it's a beautiful book by a materials scientist who talks about objects and materials and inventions that have influenced society as they've been being made. And so it's a beautiful book about history and science and materials. And Anissa Ramirez is just a wonderful storyteller. Her book feels like you're reading historical fiction because it's so immersive. So that's one that I'm almost finished with it. I'm going to have a review up on readmorescience.com soon, my blog. And I'm really looking forward to getting it out there because it's one that I really highly recommend for people who enjoy historical looks at science that are also intersectional.
I love that. I'm terrible with book titles. Like, you're so much better than me. I read this, it was such a crazy cool book, but it was, it was put together. It was like, if you got thrown into the past by a time machine, let's say you were thrown to the 1500s or something like that, how you could make stuff from the materials that would be similar to what we have today. And it's like almost impossible.
Wow.
Just because of the machinery that we have today to extract like whatever, like borax, for example, it just wasn't a thing that they had back then. So it went through, this is what you would need to do to, to build a computer. And it was like an impossible, basically it was an impossible feat. I'm just stuttering, but reading it, it was like reading a story. It wasn't like reading, a heady science textbook. So it sounds like both of these books are easy to pick up and read and they just grip you.
Yes, both of them definitely are. And I love Anissa Ramirez takes a really unique approach because she actually writes dialogue into her book between the historical figures as they're like working on producing steel at, mass production. And so it's really neat because she is taking kind of a creative liberty in doing that. But the result is that as a reader, you're just in the moment, like it's like you're transported back into the past and you get to experience what's happening along with the characters. And that's a really unique thing for a popular science book, especially one about history, to do. Because we normally get that from someone like Mary Roach, who writes books that are more about modern science topics. She does lots of dialogue between scientists and during her interviews, but it was so interesting to get that dialogue from historical characters.
Yeah, I love that. I'm totally down for anything historical with that kind of like touch of personal, like the amount of people that have fallen in love with like the show called Outlander, which is mixes his history with science and fantasy and puts words into famous people's mouths. I think people just fell in love with that. So while this book isn't the same, but that kind of like genre is really touching to a lot of people. That's cool.
Absolutely. And people who enjoy that will definitely like this book.
That's cool. That's awesome. So Sarah, you've kind of switched gears in the last little bit. You are in an undergrad for microbiology. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the draw to biology and microbiology for you from writing science? Or maybe that will continue, but you're now in an undergrad.
Yeah. So like I said, when I transferred into university, I changed my major from literature to microbiology specifically. And so that was quite a big transition. And I started that microbiology program this past fall. So I've always been interested in biology and the biological sciences, but it really wasn't until I read Ed Yong's book, I Contain Multitudes, that I became interested in the microcosmos. And it's amazing to me that our world is composed not only of the things that we can see, but so much of life itself depends on these microorganisms that we can see the effects of, but not the actual organism itself, because they're so small. And I mentioned I love the ocean. And so I decided to major in aquatic microbiology so I could go into marine microbial ecology.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. And at Oregon State University, I've actually been working in Dr. Stephen Giovannoni's lab, where they study a very abundant type of marine bacteria called SAR-11. And Dr. Giovannoni actually is famous for first discovering SAR-11. And so it's just been such an honor to be an undergraduate assistant in his lab.
That's so cool. I'm just going to tell a quick story. We take once a year, not unfortunately this year because of COVID, but we take kids from Alberta to the Banfield Marine Biology Center on Vancouver Island. It's like on the very west coast.
Yeah.
And it's like life-changing for a lot of these kids. Some of them just immediately after that trip, they switch into biology, or they want to go into marine biology, or they want to do something with the environment, right? But every scoop of seawater underneath any kind of microscope, it will blow your mind. Like, it's just, that's the thing that gets these kids like so like hooked. And like we go out on different boats and take scoops and take samples from different depths and different mixtures, like brackish water. And yeah, so I can see the fascination with that. And you're studying the things that are even smaller that most light microscopes probably have difficulty picking up.
Yeah,
so that's super interesting.
Yeah, and another area of aquatic microbiology that I'm currently doing a research project in is actually the microbiomes of streams in the Pacific Northwest. We have here in Oregon these streams called salmon runs, where salmon, you know, they mm-hmm. run up the streams and spawn. And so I'm working with Dr. Rick Colwell's lab at OSU to see how the microbiomes of salmon runs change depending on whether the salmon are present or not. So I'm really fascinated with the effects these microorganisms have on the rest of their ecosystems.
You could get into an hours long discussion of that, the whole salmon cycle. It is like, for people who don't know anything about it, that is, they're just incredible organisms. They come from the ocean inland and then get back out again. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and because of that change, it really influences the different microorganisms that are present. And so mm-hmm. that's actually an area that scientists really don't know much about. And so it's raising a lot of questions. So it's exciting to be helping with a research project on it, because it's new information. It's going to be new knowledge.
And, you know, if you ever have to go get a sample, you're traipsing about through some of the most gorgeous country in the entire world too. So,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, oh, we got to go get a sample. We got to go on this gorgeous hike, or, you know, for the folks on the west coast of Canada, oh, we got to take a boat out into the, well, I guess it could be raining sideways, but I mean, if it's a nice day, it's pretty much the most picturesque place you could ever imagine. So it's such a hardship.
Yeah, especially here during the summer. It's nice and warm and sunny, and the coast is beautiful. So I can't wait until we can go take samples.
That's awesome. As I said before, I'm a little jealous. Another question I have for you, we'll go back to writing, because you have way more experience with that than really the average person. And I just want you, maybe if you could explain to people what is the importance of science writing and science communication? Why is there a need for that?
I'm really, really glad that you asked this question, because having skilled science writers is so important, because the public depends on us to essentially translate important scientific information into something people without a PhD in that field can understand. So science journalists are trained to sift through technical scientific language, cut it down to the basics, and then lay it out in a way that the general public can understand. So right now, some of the most important yet completely overlooked people in the world are actually health journalists. everyone depends on the news for information about COVID-19 and updates on what the coronavirus is, what kind of research is being done to combat it. And it's science and health journalists, but also science communicators in general, who bear the burden of making that information available to the public. So not only that, but they have to help stop the spread of misinformation, make sure that their own interpretations aren't false or blown out of proportion. The work that science writers do is extremely important, and more people should know, you know, this is a career that exists and contributes something important to the world.
Well, thanks for explaining that. That was a much better job than if I was to try and just randomly explain that to people too as well. Yeah, it strikes a chord with me because I don't know if I'd consider myself a science communicator with the podcast, but because I teach high school science and I'm a chemist, I'm kind of the science person for people on Facebook and the community. So like hydroxychloroquine, like shot to the front from some terrible, like not terrible study, but like it was a very small study through anecdotal reports in, I think it was France or something like that. It was like, yeah, it kind of helped and it was good. And then people were using that as proof. And a lot of the science writers were like, hold on a second. Just wait.
Right.
So that's what I was like. I went to that and I was like, wait, there's like 50 people in this anecdotal kind of like word of mouth study. That's not science. That's like, that's like if you ask 50 people where they like to eat, that's not, you know, that's different.
it's more of a poll.
Yeah, it's more of a poll. Yeah. You make such a good point. Just one more thing I'll just say real quick is I do a science bit every week on the podcast and I do go back to the main studies. And sometimes the main studies, even with my science training, I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about here. This is nonsensical to me. So I'm very grateful because sometimes I'll troll other like science writers who have done a better job than me of kind of like parsing out the results. So yeah, it's so important.
Well, we get stuck in that technical stuff all the time too. And I think one of the advantages that science journalists have is that with our journalism training, we actually learn how to interview the scientists and the authors of these studies in a way that they can help us make sense of their papers. And so if you're trying to sift through a study and you're like, you know, I'm just not getting this, I'm hitting my head against a wall, it's great to be able to interview the authors of the study and actually have them help us understand what we're saying and what we're trying to communicate to the public. So definitely don't beat yourself up about it. It's something that we have to do every single day.
Yeah. The chemistry ones, I'm like, okay, I get it. And I hit some physics one about a neutron star. And I was like, oh, what is going? No, just no, I don't know. So it was too much.
Yep. I'm going to add real quick. I think you're totally a science communicator. I think it's really important that we define science communication broadly because there's all different forms of science communication, you know, podcasts, writing, journalism, books, all kinds of things, even photography, even tweeting. So if, you know, me, an undergrad who, you know, doesn't even have a PhD yet can hop on Twitter and do some science communication through tweets and articles, you know, if that counts, I think it should just be defined really broadly.
I like that. Thanks. I do consider the dog accounts the dog account I run, Bunsen and now Beaker. Yeah. I find it so, I don't know, it's either heartening or disheartening. But when, like, for example, I make up a tweet about vaccines, I do get pushback now that the account is so big. Like I'll get some hate messages directly messaged to me or comments of people I have to block, but it's nowhere near the vitriol that human science communicators get when they post something on that nature. So I'm not sure what it is about dogs. People are less likely to get pissy or people are less likely to get angry at dogs than they are at humans. So, I don't know what that is. I don't know.
That's so interesting that you bring that up because one of the things that I did this year was I I told my story growing up in kind of an anti-vaccine household, and I shared it for a vaccine campaign during my first year at Oregon State University. And I was definitely not prepared for the pushback when those videos went live. And all of a sudden, I'm getting emails and messages from people saying that they're going to get me kicked out of university. And how dare I suggest people get vaccinated? So that was quite an interesting experience.
I feel so bad for, like, I'm just stuttering here. It's just gross. Yeah, I don't know what it is about dogs and maybe and humans and the topics, but some people go mental with things that they think are true. There's a lot of misinformation out there. So right. I guess just to close this section, I'm glad there's people like you and everybody working together through science communication and writing to stop the spread of misinformation. I really feel North America and parts of Europe are going to have an uphill battle if and when the coronavirus vaccine is rolled out. I think that we're going to have to all come together on that for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, actually one of the really heartening things to me, because I've also been worried about that and I can be a little pessimistic considering the state of the country, but something that really cheered me up was the other day I was talking to my dad, who is, you know, he's not someone I would think of as very pro-science. He was very much the one who felt strongly that his kids should not be vaccinated when we were growing up. But with regards to the coronavirus, the other day he told me he's looking forward to them having some kind of vaccine for it. And that was really encouraging to hear. I'm glad that people can experience that kind of growth.
There is hope. There's hope. Education is the key. I think that's the main thing. Yeah. And you get through to one person, you might not get through to 10, but you get through to one. You've done your job. That's great.
Yeah.
Especially if it's your dad.
Yeah. Sometimes it's more easy to start with family members.
And yeah, that's
family
that's
members
true.
Are more willing to listen to you. So that's nice.
Yeah, that's true. Instead of you're just some random person on the internet or some internet dog telling you to get vaccinated, there don't have to say. Well, okay. So speaking of, this is a great transition. Speaking of dogs and pets and things like that,
we
always ask our guests for a pet story. It really makes you, as this voice people are listening to, like make a connection with people that love the podcast. Most people who listen to the podcast love science and pets. Can you share a pet story with us from your life?
Oh my gosh. Yes. So
yay.
A lot of anyone who knows me knows that I love hamsters. And I actually have one named Linus Pauling after the Nobel Prize winning scientist who's really famous here at Oregon State University. So when I was a kid, my little sister and I had all kinds of rodents. We loved mice and rats. And our first hamster was this huge, chunky, orange teddy bear hamster named Nibbles. And hamsters are notorious escape artists. So one night, Nibbles figured out how to bust out of her habitat. And my sister and I shared a room downstairs. And Nibbles escaped from our bedroom and climbed up the stairs. And at the time, my family also had two cats, and they were indoor cats that didn't hunt and were pretty frankly terrified by our rodents. And so we imagined that they must have just stood there and watched Nibbles wander her way into the kitchen, because she found their food bowl and filled her cheek pouches with every last bit of the cat food, and then waddled her way all the way back down the stairs, back into me and my sister's bedroom, and proceeded to bring all of the cat food home with her. So the next morning, we woke up to her just chowing down on the cat food, and the cats were sitting there watching her with just these devastated looks on their faces, like they'd been betrayed.
How many trips do you think the hamster took?
Yeah, and it was so funny because, you know, it showed us our cats really would never harm our little rodent friends, and so that was encouraging, but it was pretty funny.
It's like the look Bunsen gives us with our new puppy Beaker, because she is she is just merciless and relentless with playing with him, and sometimes I think he's like had enough, and he like looks at us, he's like, is this really happening? Is this my life now? And we're like,
Sorry, big guy. If she's biting you, she's not biting us. poor guy. I love that. Yeah, that's what a cool study. So the hamster's name was Nibbles.
It was Nibbles. Yeah, sister named him. that's
cute. That's perfect for if Nibbles, the cat food stealer.
Oh yeah, she was a little food thief.
Do you have hamsters? You have a hamster net right now, I think you said, right? That was named after.
Yeah. So yeah. I had this lovely little hamster, Linus Pauling. I had him for about a year, and then I recently actually gave him to a friend to look after because my cat, I have two cats that I got in December, and they are way too interested in the hamster, not at all like my childhood cats. And so we thought he would be much happier in a cat-free household. So I'm going to go see him next week. So I'm pretty excited. I get pictures of him all the time.
That's cute. Were the cats like just sitting outside of his cage, stressing him out?
Oh my gosh. They actually broke into his cage at one point, which happened during a Zoom meeting. So I'm like in class, you know, in a meeting doing something. And all of a sudden there's this huge crash and meowing, and they had broken into the hamster cage. And so I thought, okay, that's the last straw.
Yeah, you don't want your little buddy getting ate by your other buddies, for sure.
I think he'd put up a good fight. He's about half the size of them.
Oh, he's a big one.
He's a big one. People see him and they're like, is that a guinea pig?
Yeah, I was going to say. That's cute. Well, thanks for sharing your pet stories. That's super cool. That's super cool. Another guest I've had on before, Sophia Gadnassar, who's a astrophysicist. She has hamsters too, and she names them after particles, which is really cute. I love it.
Yeah, Sophia's really cool.
Oh, you know her or follow her? Hey, yeah.
Yeah. We like to share pictures of hamsters with each other.
So there's hamster Twitter. Is that what this is? Because I'm finding out there's fish Twitter, and fish Twitter is at war with bird Twitter. And now there's hamster Twitter. So this is great. The factions are forming. I know there's dog Twitter. One of the other questions we always ask our guests for is a super fact. And a super fact is something that you know that when you tell people, it kind of like blows their mind. And it can be about anything, not science related. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do, although mine is definitely science related because
I'm
obsessed with my field of study. So one of my favorite examples of some mind-blowing marine microbial ecology is the giant tube worm. So these are weird kind of alien-looking marine invertebrate that live in the Pacific Ocean near hydrothermal vents. So they don't have a mouth or a gut or a butt. And so scientists couldn't figure out how they survived. They didn't know how they ate or where they got their nutrients from. And then one day this grad student was listening to a professor talk about the tube worm, and she suggested that they might have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria that get energy from the hydrogen sulfide coming from the hydrothermal vents. And as it turned out, she was right. The tube worm... Yep. So the tube worm gets its food through chemoautotrophic symbiosis, thanks to this special organ called the trophosome, where the bacteria that break down the hydrogen sulfide live. So it's a pretty cool relationship between some very weird marine organisms. And it's actually what inspired my interest in marine microbial ecology.
Okay. What was that process called again? Chemo something, something, something.
It's chemoautotrophic symbiosis.
Oh my goodness. So through, I'm just trying to break down the words, right?
Through
living close together, it produces its own food through chemicals, basically.
Yeah. No. So since you said you have a chemistry background, the organisms kind of feed on the hydrogen sulfide, and the byproduct is energy through nutrients and stuff that the tube worm then takes in. So they've got a relationship. They work together.
Does this cut the sun out entirely? Is this one of the organisms on Earth that isn't involved? Like the sun cycle, the photosynthetic cycle doesn't
really affect these guys?
Yeah, so you can almost imagine it as this is photosynthesis that uses chemicals instead of sunlight.
That's amazing. That gives me hope for other planets, right? Maybe you're like, Europa or something, one of the icy moons of Jupiter. You could not necessarily even need sunlight to have all this life that could exist.
Yeah, and that's what astrobiologists study, is they're looking for signs of microbial life on other planets because they might come across something that's got, you know, a symbiotic relationship with bacteria, you know, and I think that's why it's important that we study the ocean floor and the, you know, kind of weird alien-like creatures that live there, because that will, you know, it'll tell us a lot about what might be out there on other planets.
I love it. I also have chemo autotrophic synthesis in my back pocket for Scrabble, because I ever get that, the game's over. It's just done.
Oh, yeah.
It's done, guys. Yeah, triple word score, 10,000 points, game over. Chemo autotrophic synthesis for the win. I don't actually, I think you'd have to go diagonal. I don't know if you'd be able to go left to right with that, so.
I'll have to break it out next time I play Scrabble with my husband and his mom. We all play Scrabble together all the time.
Oh, you have such an unfair advantage. You're a science writer. You'd have all of these terms.
They always
you would destroy them. Oh, they do? Oh.
they're too good. They're both very like sciencey writer people, and so his mom's a writer, and he also studies science, and so they're too good.
I am an awful speller, as probably people who follow Bunsen's account can attest to his typos, and then I just like, oh, it's because he's that's a dog that's texting, exactly. And he's got great big paws. Like, it's not my fault because I can't spell. So I get wrecked every time I play Scrabble against my wife because she can spell. I'm like, hey, Chris, how do you spell career? Like an easy word that I should know how to spell. But I've got this word now. So thank you, Sarah. I'm kind of excited about the last part of our chat. I've changed up the podcast interview, and I give guests kind of a section where they talk about something that's really important to them that isn't necessarily related to science. And we were chatting before about you have a passion, or see, you have a horse that you've rescued that you've brought into your life. Can you tell everybody about that?
Yeah. So outside of science, I'm really passionate about rescuing animals, finding them forever homes, and especially taking care of pets that would otherwise be overlooked if they have health issues and that sort of thing. So if you follow my Twitter, you'll inevitably get a lot of updates about whatever critter has found its way into my life. So most recently, I rescued my first horse, which was something of a lifelong dream of mine. I've always loved horses. I've always wanted one of my own. And this horse came from a feedlot, known as a kill pen. So if you aren't familiar, these are places horses go when they're old or have health issues and their owner can't take care of them anymore. So people will buy them and ship them out of the United States to be slaughtered because it's not legal in the United States, but it is legal to ship them out of the country for it. So it's really not a pleasant place for horses to be. They're usually pretty traumatized and malnourished. So my horse, her name is Dharma, and she's a thoroughbred. She was put in a kill pen because she's got an injury on one of her back legs. And so I'm guessing her owner thought, you know, she'd probably never recover because she's already approaching her senior years. But she got a second chance, and she's actually healing really well. So now we're getting some weight and some muscle on her, getting her in shape. So outside of school and science, she's my project right now.
Okay, so that's amazing. I'm sorry if I missed the last little section there. Where is the horse now?
Oh, I didn't mention it. So she's living on a farm, kind of like in someone's backyard, barnyard. They've so she lives about 10 minutes down the road from me, so it's great because I hop on my bike or I take the car and I go see her every morning and evening. And so I feed her a couple times a day and check on her, make sure she's healing well, make sure she's healthy. So that's been it's such a wonderful way to start and end the day.
Aw, that's great. They are such cool. They are such cool creatures. We live on a farm in, like, that's where we live in Canada, in Alberta. We live on a farm. And we had horses, not me personally, but my wife and her, I guess sort of through my wife, they had horses. So they're crazy cool creatures. For people that are listening, the expense for their upkeep can be very expensive. And I think that's what gets people into trouble with horses, is they're maybe not, they don't understand the economics of owning a horse, and vet bills too. Yeah. So
that was really an obstacle for me going, like, I've always wanted to own horses and ride, but that was the biggest obstacle. But where I live now, it's a lot cheaper to own horses than where I grew up. And one of the ways that I've been making it more affordable is I do all the work for the horse myself. And so her boarding expense, since I live in an apartment, she can't live with me, obviously. So I pay her board, and I go out and I feed her, and I do the barn chores. And I recently got a barn cat too, because to keep the mice out of her feed. So that's been fun.
That's awesome. Cats and horses have such a cool relationship in history, actually. That's kind of a neat historical thing.
Yeah, they really do. And the barn cat, her name is Bella. I introduced them to each other the other day, and Dharma just had this shocked expression on her face, like she was trying to figure out what this little cat was, because she's seen dogs before, but I don't know whether she's ever had a cat around the barn. And so she was like following the cat around the pasture. It's like, what are you?
That's such an inspirational story. And for people that are listening that do love animals, that's something that maybe people don't know happens to a lot of horses, and in Canada it happens as well. Unlike your country, Canada does allow horse slaughter, and it's kind of this, it is a very controversial topic for sure. For if it's going to happen, perhaps it's not the most humane system. There perhaps needs to be more regulation about it. So yeah, it is a good topic that you brought up for people to think about.
Yeah. And she's a thoroughbred, and a lot of she's not an ex racehorse, but a lot of thoroughbreds that people rescue are ex racehorses, and racing is very hard on their legs, and so unfortunately a lot of thoroughbreds do end up in kill pens. And really the challenge is that because they get transported out of the United States, that's really hard on them because it's so many miles spent in a trailer. And so that's really the thing that frustrates a lot of people here, is the whole transportation of animals.
Yeah, that's rough on them, especially if they're injured and they have to stand all that time.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I get it totally. Yep. Get it.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool because thoroughbreds, I like to think that they kind of run in my blood, because my great-grandfather came to the United States from Norway and was a horse trainer. Specifically, he worked with racehorses and thoroughbreds. And his daughter, my grandma, grew up working with and riding thoroughbreds. And so it's really cool to, now I have my own that I'm training and working with. So even though my love for horses and my interest in science are kind of separate worlds, I'm hoping to find some way to combine them, maybe with a book on equine science or something.
I love it. And that's the other thing that's really interesting for people that are listening that maybe have never rode a horse before. It should be on your bucket list to try. I mean, they were so entwined with human transportation historically, and they're like, I'm a big guy, like I'm 6'3". So when I rode horse, when I used to ride horses, and when I still do ride horse sometimes, it's just amazing that this creature can hold me. Like, they're just so powerful. And it's really like, it's almost like nothing to them. They just hop up and they're like, okay, all right, here we go.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they really used to be intertwined with everyday life.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And now, you know, there's people who will go most of, if not their entire lives, without ever riding a horse or touching a horse,
or seeing one in real life. Yes,
right, yeah. right. Yeah, like until I got this horse, my husband had never he still has yet to ride a horse, and so I'm kind of introducing him to Dharma, and they're getting to know each other, and I'm hoping that once she's, you know, more rideable, I can have him hop on and do some lessons.
That's cool. I'm so glad I got to talk to you about this. I'm not I don't want people to think that I'm some cowboy. But like I have, it's not something that I'm not like as skilled probably as you are with horses. One of the things that I do know a lot about is, the big horses, because I did grow up in, and like rural Alberta around, families that had the, people probably can picture a Clydesdale horse. They're the giant cart pulling horses. Probably two times as big as your horse or bigger.
Right.
And then Canada has this special type of horse, and it's nicknamed the Shire horse. And it's even bigger than a Clydesdale. Like, if you've never seen one, like they have a few of them around where we live, and they look like dinosaurs. They're like as big as a moose.
Oh, yeah.
They're so big. They're just amazing creatures.
Yeah, I definitely cultivated a love for draft horses at a young age because I had the privilege of actually growing up near the pasture where the Budweiser Clydesdales were kept. I have pictures of me as a little kid standing next to this horse that just dwarfs me because we would go visit the Clydesdales and get to pet them and stand with them. And that was such a cool experience, especially as a kid, because, I mean, you're just blown away by the size of these horses.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah. And even as an adult, they dwarf you. Like, they're just magnificent creatures. So for the folks that are listening, if you've never pet a horse or been around a horse, make sure that's on your bucket list, or maybe even try to ride a horse.
Right. Go on a trail ride.
Go on a trail ride. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know what? This has been such a fun chat, Sarah, but we're at the end of our conversation. Where can people find you on social media?
So you can find me by my Twitter handle. It's @readmorescience. And it's the same as my website, readmorescience.com. And you can find me on Instagram @readmorescience as well.
Good job keeping it consistent.
I try.
And we'll have all of those links in our show notes, folks. As I've said before, you are literally one little click away. You don't even have to like type it in, guys. You just go to the show notes and you do clickety click and poof, it's Sarah's stuff. So yeah, there's no excuse, folks. Is there any cause or organization you think folks listening should check out?
Yeah, so a cause that's really important right now is an organization called Skype a Scientist, and it's helping get scientists connected to classrooms and specifically students who are stuck at home right now during the pandemic. And it's great because we can bring science straight to kids who, you know, they don't have a whole lot to do right now when they're at home during quarantine. So Skype a Scientist is a great, great organization helping address that need right now.
All right. Well, this is the end. I could talk to you for hours about horses and hamsters and amazing books that I should be reading instead of playing or watching my wife and my son play Animal Crossing. So I should get out there and do that instead. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk to us on the Science Podcast, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Science is for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast. And I don't know if I'm crazy, but I've got Adam and Chris back as the guest hosts for Woo or Wow.
Yay!
Yeah, he just couldn't get enough of how hilarious the last one was, and there was positive feedback, which is awesome. So maybe we'll be Permaguests. No, just kidding.
No. And do you guys think you'll get it right this time?
Probably not.
I'm really hoping so.
The category this week is microorganisms.
Yay, because I know everything about microorganisms.
Microorganisms. All right, you guys ready to hear the three statements? Remember, in woo or wow, two of the statements are fake. They are woo, and one of the statements is true. It's a wow. First statement. There are more microbes in your body than actual cells that make up your body. Statement two. If you took all of the microbes in your body and weighed it, it would be about 10% of your total weight.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Kind of like the last one where it was talking about the amount of microbes versus your cells. And now it's...
Yeah, so one of those is true and one of those is fake. Or they're just both fake.
They could be. They could be both fake news.
The third statement. Humans didn't catch a glimpse of the first microbe until the microscope was invented in the early 1900s.
If I'm being honest, the way that Dad words crap, no, that one's not true.
Are you saying like the, how he, what's the word? Bamboozle?
Mm-hmm.
The bamboozle words?
Yeah. You can't see it with your eye, but I don't know, you could see it with a magnifying glass if you had a strong enough one. I don't know. I don't think we need a microscope.
Okay.
To see the microbes?
Yeah.
All right, here are the three statements. First statement, there are more microbes in your entire body than cells that make up your body. Statement two, if you took all the microbes in your body and weighed them, it would be roughly 10% of your total body mass. The third statement, microbes were first discovered in the 1900s by the creation of the light microscope.
Okay, problem with statement number two, mass isn't weight.
Right, mass versus weight.
If you took all the microbes in your body and weighed them, their mass would be more than your body. So, yeah, mass and weight are different.
Okay, so you don't think the third one is true with the microscope?
And I don't know.
I'm with you on that one. But you know what? Unfortunately, the first one I think is true because I just think of all the microbes that are on your skin and on your body.
And in your body
and everywhere. There's just like so many of them. I want to say that there's more microbes than there are cells.
Okay.
So I'm going with number one as the wow.
And if you're going with number one, that means that you don't think number two is true.
No.
So I'm going to spread our bases and go with number three.
You're going to go with number three?
Yeah.
That's true?
Yes.
That's the micro?
The microscope? The microscope, yep.
Yep.
Okay, final answer.
Yep.
I'm going with number one. All those creepy crawlies are all over the body.
Did you know that if you grabbed every organ in your body and laid it out, you'd be dead?
Yeah, yes, Adam. Same thing if you stacked all of the elephants on Earth to space, they'd die.
Yeah.
Okay, enough of this morbid, terrible jokes we tell each other on long drives to the mountains. So let's take a look at the second statement. You did not choose the second statement, which means that if it's true, you lose right away.
Which means that if you chose it first, it's definitely fake.
So the second statement is not true.
Oh, good. Yay. High five.
Yeah, so you got that one done. If you took all of the microbes in your body and weighed it, it wouldn't be 10% of your body weight. It would be the same weight as about your brain. So it does weigh quite a bit. And for some people, depending on their brain size, it may be a little less than others.
Hmm.
Don't, Mom. I know who you're going to say. Don't say it.
I wasn't going to disparage anybody.
So which one do you want me to do, Adam's or yours, Chris? Let's do Adam's.
You're building up the...
Do yours?
No, I don't know. I'm scared.
The third statement about when the microbe was first discovered in the 1900s is woo.
Woo. Oh,
so that means Chris Adam is right.
What? So, I just think of all those creepy crawlies.
Antoine von Leeuwenhoek discovered the first microorganism with his very primitive microscope in 1674.
Okay, so it was a microscope, but it was the wrong date.
Yeah.
Okay.
Many, many years before the 1900s.
Because if you think of Galileo,
they were very close to building, actually, the electron microscope in the 1900s, early 1900s.
Yeah, yeah, because you just think of, like, the time frame.
Okay.
With the age of...
Well, I was just spreading our bases, Mom.
That's true. That was good, because you guys both picked the wrong one last time. So Adam was wrong, Mom was right this time. It is true, there are more microbes in your body than actual body cells. There's actually around 100 times more microbes than body cells. Well, you won. Chris won. Adam lost. But because Adam picked spread his base, he increased your chances of winning.
That's good.
I did say that monkeys could have found the crap.
You did.
I did say that I was the one who said that I don't think that number three is true.
How many cells are in the human body?
I have no idea.
Okay.
That's not part of Woo or Wow. Wait, I asked the questions here. This isn't Woo or Wow, back to Woo. All right.
It's back to you,
back
Jason.
To me. Okay.
Back to the future.
So, Adam, you're going to learn about Antoine von Leeuwenhoek next year.
Fun.
Or this year, actually, as long as coronavirus doesn't shut you down.
Yay.
All right, that's Woo or Wow for this week.
Thank you. It was so fun to be a guest here.
We're going to cut this out. We're going to cut that out.
It's cut that out. Cut that out.
Okay, it's time for story time with me,
Adam.
And it's story time, my part of this podcast, where we talk about stories that have happened within the story time timeline of relevancy, which is actually today, because all of our stories happen today. Fun times. Okay, so Mom, do you have an epic story to tell on my section of the podcast?
I sure do. So today we went to a reservoir lake in Canmore, and we got stand-up paddle boards to try, and then we also brought out our inflatable kayak, which has been an amazing investment for our family. Anyway, so this allowed all three of us and two dogs to go out onto the water. So I started with just Bunsen and I, and then Jason had Beaker, but pretty much immediately she yeeted off the stand-up paddleboard and she swam like a little muskrat to the kayak. So now I'm trying to navigate with an 89-pound dog and a wet dog. Anyway, so we're all in the kayak, and I was having a little bit of trouble because I'm not a very experienced kayaker, so I was having trouble turning right, and I got too close to the side. This was funny because Beaker also, actually Bunsen jumped out first, and because we were on the side, and then he had to swim a little bit, and he wasn't happy about that, and then we got Bunsen back, and then Beaker was swimming around, so... We were a little bit worried there for a second when they were out of the kayak. But anyway, it all worked out well. Jason, he says he fell in, but I think he jumped in to save the day.
I fell.
Jason fell in. but that still saved the day because he was able to step up on the sharp rocks and get the dogs, save the damsel in distress, which was me, in the kayak.
Just because you can't turn right.
I can't turn right. So I was trying to turn right. And
you
I'm like,
paddle right to go right.
So like even Jason said, hey, you're going the wrong way. I said, I know. I said, I can't go left. And so I just went into a circle. So I was able to get on course.
You know, three wrongs don't make a right, but three rights make a left. And Mommy, we're not going to go on to a tangent where we cut it all out. Dad, what about your story?
It's really quick. You probably, if you've watched the video on Twitter, I was wearing a GoPro on my head and it caught me falling backwards. I did fall because I was like wondering, Chris was yelling and I turned around. I'm not great on a paddleboard, like spinning around and looking the other way, and I went backwards. Anyways, my story is after we got all back and the dogs were wet, I wanted to go for a swim. So I was like, hey, Bunsen, let's go for a swim. And I had the leash on. I was kind of dragging him towards the water. And he's like, he made a split second decision that made us all laugh. Instead of going into the water, he leaped into the kayak. He's like, if I'm going to go in the water, I'm going to be in the kayak. It was so funny. And he sat there. He's like, aha, I win. I'm in the kayak. You can't put me in the water. So that's my story. It was really funny. He chose the kayak, which he didn't really enjoy before today, over swimming. So I guess it's the lesser of two evils.
Because from The Office, I learned that people with rabies have a fear of water. Anyway, my story time. It's time for my story. My story is pretty cool. We went into Canmore, and we got recognized. We got recognized. This is the part of being famous where we're actually famous. We got recognized by the Bear Brothers, which is Mac and Bodhi, which are two burners.
Yeah.
Which are two burners. Service dogs. I love service dogs. They're so great. And burners are great service dogs because they're so great. I realized on the way back to the car, we are like the son or daughter of a famous person. Like, you know a famous person, let's say Chris Pratt, all right? You've got Chris Pratt. And you've got Chris Pratt's son or daughter or whatever. And they are indirectly famous because their dad is famous. And with Bunsen and Beaker, we're indirectly famous because they're like, hey, that's the dog dad of Bunsen, or hey, that's the dog mom, or hey, that's Adam Bobadam. But yeah, we got recognized. Fun times. We had fun in Canmore. We're going home tomorrow. And yes, it is time to turn off the podcast for today. See ya.
And that's the end of another podcast episode. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks to Sarah Michelle Olson, who talked to us about being a science writer and author, switching gears into microorganisms, and taking care of a horse. We also give a shout out to our top tier patrons. If you want to hear your name at the end of the podcast, head over to the Patreon page and sign up. Take it away, Chris.
Catherine Lynch, Judith Morton, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Daniel Fry, Shelby Leggett, Karen Beth St. George, Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Kathy Zerker, Liz Button, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the Science Dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.